I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. The theme for this our program is examining the AIDS scandal, though most people are unaware there were scandals concerning AIDS, and how that correlates with what many consider the COVID scandal. Why? Because the same individual, Anthony Fauci, was responsible for overseeing both. My guest via Zoom is Tom DiFernando. He is an injury and trauma therapist. He has been active in the AIDS movement for a long time, in fact, for over 30 years. He served as the executive director of HEAL, which stands for Health Education AIDS Liaison, for over 20 years, working head-to-head with HEAL's president, Dr. Michael Ellner. During that time, he led hundreds of HEAL meetings for thousands of HIV-positive people. He spoke at many dissident AIDS conferences around the world and organized and hosted conferences and interviews featuring leaders of the AIDS dissident movement, including Dr. Roberto Giraldo, Celia Farber, John Lawrenson, Joan Shenton, Dr. Robert Wilner, Dr. James McMeo, among others. And presently, Tom is the president of the Rethinking AIDS, Unmasking COVID, a group of scientists, physicians, and activists, many of them early veteran AIDS dissidents, all of whom have been heavily censored by mainstream print, visual, and social media sources, especially now in the time of COVID. Tom's revised Rethinking AIDS website to rethinkingaids.com. Nice to have you with us today, Tom.
Thank you, Gary. Good to hear you. Glad to be here.
Tom, let me give a little background since I have been involved in this from the very beginning. In fact, I was involved in the AIDS movement before it was officially called AIDS, 10 years before Robert Gallo, along with Margaret Heckler, at a French restaurant in Bethesda, Maryland, said the probable cause of AIDS had been discovered, HIV. I was working with one of America's leading physicians, gay physicians, Dr. Stephen Chiesa. He was unable to help certain people, and he couldn't figure out what was wrong. And so I work with probably somewhere around 700, 800 of them. And I found after extensive interviews that most had common backgrounds, meaning they were all within the gay community, but they did not represent the majority of gays. The majority of gays just have, for all intents and purposes, a regular normal life except for their sexual preferences and their perceptions on what it is to be gay. These individuals primarily had what we would call a fast-track lifestyle, very similar to the swingers who were heterosexual who had a fast-track lifestyle. They were using a lot of drugs. They had a lot of unprotected sex. They were not healthy. And over a period of time, their body succumbed to this. They had multiple viruses and infections. So by helping them clean up their body, detoxification programs, rejuvenation programs, the vast majority got well. That's why this relationship with Dr. Chiesa continued to help his patients. And in fact, many times he came up there. In fact, one of the people who came up was Michael Ellner, who was a friend of mine. And it was Michael who helped found HEAL. In fact, many of the meetings of HEAL were held in my corporate headquarters, first on 84th and Riverside Drive in a brownstone I had for several years, and then at a larger space down on 72nd and Broadway for about 15 years. And I saw thousands of people come through the HEAL meetings, and I was writing about what I considered the pain, profit, and politics of AIDS. HIV was real, people were getting sick, but how to go about doing the original diagnosis was what was being challenged, and also the therapeutic model to treat them. For example, AZT, the very toxic drug, was also being challenged. And a lot of scientists, including multiple Nobel Prize winners, did not believe that Anthony Fauci and Robert Gallo had gotten it right. They believed that there was too narrow a view, that everything was about making profit and controlling the narrative. And to that degree, they allowed a very radicalized group to, for all intents and purposes, be the official spokesperson within the gay community and to the American media about what it was to have AIDS. And they all had the same thing. AIDS is a death sentence. Sooner or later, you're going to die of AIDS if you're HIV infected. And we disagreed with that. Because here I was reversing AIDS. 1,200 people who came near death, very seriously ill, with AIDS-defining illnesses, all reversed their AIDS symptoms. One small group of 18 who decided to go on a very extensive protocol, everyone reversed their AIDS conditions and reversed their HIV to HIV negative status. We held a press conference, nobody came. We had meetings, nobody came. We had an open door policy, no one came. It was as if there was an intentional canceling of everything that we were doing that they weren't able to do. They said there was no cure for AIDS, we were curing AIDS. And we have documented that in the documentary done by the Society for Independent Investigative Journalism. It's called The Cost of Denial. All the patients, the doctors, the journalists are all in there proving we were curing AIDS. And one step to helping people was heal. And that's where you came in. So this is the larger overview. What I'd like for you to do now is take your time and give us your perspective, because none of the media knew that there were dissidents. They only had heard of Peter Duisberg, and he was used as the sacrificial lamb by the establishment to destroy him. And all the other people, no one ever knew that you had thousands of dissidents who disagreed. Just like today, there are dissidents by the tens of thousands against everything we're being told about COVID, about the treatment modalities, about the severity of the illness, and the diagnosis. So Anthony Fauci was behind both. And in the minds of many, he didn't just fail in mismanaging the war on AIDS. He was negligent to where they felt should be held in contempt for crimes against humanity. That's the larger overview. Take it from there. The forum is yours.
So thank you very much. I guess the first point I want to make is when you're talking about nobody knows that these dissidents are there, that's significant on multiple levels. One I like to point out is that because we hear with AIDS all the time, and then nowadays with COVID, that all the decisions being made related to it and all the social policy protocols and all that are based on science, they're saying. But one of the cornerstones of science, and this like ends the discussion, one of the cornerstones of science is you invite dissent. You know, you want to falsify your hypothesis. So the fact that all dissenting views are being censored and blocked, deplatformed, but you know, prima facie right there, that means there is no science in what is going on. That is much more of a marketing campaign. I mean, if there's any science, it's the science of marketing. You know, they've been very effective at constructing this whole narrative about AIDS being caused by a deadly retrovirus and that everybody's at risk and you need to take these toxic medications to save your life. And of course, that's the exact same thing with COVID. And like you said, it's got the exact same guy at the head, Anthony Fauci. They're also using the exact same tests in a downright fraudulent way. And they're constructing numbers as in AIDS, as in COVID. They're putting many different diseases together and then applying a PCR test, which cannot identify a microbe, identifies nucleic acids that nobody knows what they relate to or where they come from. And then so you get an old disease and you get a positive test and they call it AIDS, or today they call it COVID. So this is, there's no science in this. So as soon as any of these officials, either back then 30 years ago or today, are saying we're following the science, that's part of the marketing, is just to say we're following the science, because there is no science as long as you are censoring out and blocking the dissenting voices. I mean, if we're going to live in America, if we're going to live in a free country, you know, the whole idea of the First Amendment is like kind of important, especially in science, that you need to hear all voices because somewhere in the mix, the truth will come out. But when one side is systematically blocking everybody else, then that, of course, is not freedom. That's totalitarianism. So, yeah, that gets to the broader social problem that you're hinting at there. When you're talking about, like, Fauci should be up on crimes against humanity, it's for good reason. But the censorship is so successful. That's why I say it's almost like there's a science to the marketing, that most people don't have a clue that there are dissidents, that there are first-rate scientists and physicians and even activists speaking out on this, saying, no, there's too many contradictions. You know, I mean, for example, you know, deadly COVID. But in fact, what's it? Well, over 80% of the people dying from what they're calling COVID are elderly people who already have three or four pre-existing life-threatening diseases. Okay, that's kind of weird. That also means that of all the people they're saying are dying of COVID, 500,000 or whatever number they're making up now, that if you subtract out the comorbidities and the other diseases, you get less than 20,000 COVID deaths in all of 2020 in America. Less than 20,000. I mean, this is outrageous. One of the things for me that highlights the insanity in all this is a simple graph. One graph blows it all out of the water. If you graph last year's so-called COVID deaths, the confirmed COVID deaths, with the confirmed COVID cases, there is zero relationship between the graph of the cases and the graph of the deaths. I mean, right there, there's no relationship. So there's no science. What is the pandemic? In fact, if you want to actually use real science, what you find is that these people are not dying of a COVID disease. The vast majority of these excess deaths, it can be shown, are due to the lockdowns, the stresses of lockdowns, businesses being destroyed, lives being destroyed, you know, the suicides, the alcoholism, everything that's ramping up. This is a lockdown pandemic. It's not a deadly viral pandemic. In fact, the symptoms of COVID are practically indistinguishable from plain old influenza. I mean, there's variations, but it's basically indistinguishable. And again, it doesn't correlate to the case numbers. It correlates to the seasons. You know, it's like conventional flu season. You know, in the wintertime, when things get cold and wet, more people, no matter the illness they have, more people die at those times. So these are just an endless string of contradictions. But when you have a propaganda machine constantly pounding on you about the narrative, you know, deadly virus, deadly disease, nothing you can do about it except turn to the doctors, then even when people see the contradictions, they don't have the confidence. I think this is one of the problems we have here, is people don't have the confidence to say what they see. You know, one of my critiques of this whole situation of how something like COVID or AIDS can take, if they're all scammed, how does it happen? Well, one of the big ones is, and speaking particularly here in America, you know, in America, if a maniacal killer comes at an American and says, I'm going to take your freedom, you know, the Americans will fight to the death to preserve their freedom. But if some scoundrel plague character guy comes up with a smile and says, well, you really should give me your freedom. Well, that confuses Americans. They don't, unless there's like an overt violent threat, they get confused. Many of them are decent people. They see somebody smiling. They think, okay, we'll give them the benefit of the doubt. They don't know how to say, I think you're lying. I think what you're telling me isn't true. Go away. This is a serious problem. If you want to kind of analyze, how can a scam like this happen? How can all this propaganda be so effective? You know, that people don't pay attention to the contradictions. So anyway, that's one thing. Let me see some more about AIDS. My experience with AIDS.
Well, let's go. Hold.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like for you to address the following.
Okay.
People are told that they are sick or infected with COVID based upon a test, the PCR test. Well, of interest is Dr. Curry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize in chemistry for discovering the PCR, made it very clear. In fact, I have an interview, you may have seen it, an hour and 52-minute yes. interview with him that I did at his home in California, where he said this should not be used for diagnosis It's not for that purpose. And it certainly is not specific enough to tell you which virus you're actually finding. And he said, you know, the more times that you have to, let's say, do the test till you can actually see a particle underneath there, the less obvious it is that you are sick with something. And yet in the United States, we have used as high as 45 repetitions of the test, and then they'll find a particle and say, oh, you're positive. And instead, it's just the opposite of what they're telling us. Now the person is told they're a case. Now it scares them to death. And they're more likely then to get their vaccines or whatever medication they're told.
That's
but
right.
That same approach happened with Robert Gallo patenting the AIDS test and marketing it. And yet when you look inside the package insert, it says the test is not to be used to determine if a person is HIV positive, and yet that's exactly what it was used for. So take us through step by step, like the contradictions between the AIDS test, the HIV antibody test, and the COVID test. And then take us through the drugs that were proposed for AIDS, the DDC, DDI, retroviral, antiretrovirals, AZT, and the spike in deaths. And also the people who are now getting the COVID vaccine, where we were told it was safe and effective, 95% effective. And now we're seeing, as of this morning, 6,133 dead minimally, plus another 5,000 in who are permanently damaged for life, and another 5,000 plus who were in critical care and still may die or be injured for life. That's about 16,000 people minimally who were injured, plus hundreds of thousands who had serious side effects. Take us through these two.
This is why what you're summarizing there is why we talk about crimes against humanity. If you have a test that requires these high cycle thresholds, and let's back up and just kind of break that down a little bit. All right, one of the hallmarks of being lied to here is that you only need a PCR process when you can't find the thing that you're looking for. So the fact that they're using PCR either for the alleged HIV or the alleged coronavirus, the fact that you're using that means you don't even have what you are looking for in the first place, because otherwise you would not need to use a PCR. You know, a PCR can find like a single molecule, a single shred of a nucleic acid, of a DNA or RNA fragment. And you start with that, okay, just using common sense, biochemically, that's not going to have any impact on your organism. If you do not have overt symptoms and you need to use a PCR to try to find an alleged pathogen, then the pathogen is not there. And even if it were there, it would have no biochemical impact. So the fact that they're using the PCR, they're already announcing to the world that they're lying to us. Now, the cycle threshold part, this is very disturbing. Again, this is why crimes against humanity. Like you said, they've been using these cycle thresholds of 40 to 45. Even Anthony Fauci acknowledged that you can see it on YouTube. He says anything over like 34 or 35 cycles in reproduction of these nucleic acids is going to give you false numbers, that you can't do that. So what does that mean? Well, if they're using cycle thresholds of 40 and above, then everything is a false positive. And as long as you use that, you can create what some have called a casedemic. Okay, this is why you didn't hear them talking about deaths after last May in 2020. They were talking about deaths in March and April, and then they stopped talking about deaths, and they started talking about cases, because most of these people were asymptomatic because they weren't sick. It was simply because of a high cycle threshold, there's a greater tendency that people are going to get positive test results. All right, so now the proof that they know this and that they're doing this is just, and now I forgot, I think it was a month ago, maybe 2 months ago, the CDC started noticing that people who get the COVID vaccine, many of them are testing positive for COVID. So what was the CDC's solution to this? Because obviously that's very bad optics. The vaccine is supposed to protect you, and how is it that you're coming out positive? I mean, let alone the fact that positive doesn't even mean that you're sick. Putting that aside, So you're getting all these positive numbers with vaccinated people. What did the CDC do? They put out a guidance for professionals and tech people to lower the cycle threshold, to retest the vaccinated person at a lower cycle threshold. I believe it was at 28. So in other words, they're going to, and not for everybody, just for people who've been taking the jab. These people get a lower cycle threshold, which decreases the likelihood of them testing positive, which has the double benefit in that then people who aren't taking the jab are going to have a tendency to test positive, and then they can say, see, you should get vaccinated. Look, you know, you've got COVID. What a scam. That's all based on this cycle threshold. It's a shame that Kerry Mullis died a couple of years ago. I mean, he was quite an outspoken critic and proponent of his own test, pointing out that you cannot diagnose a disease with a PCR. You cannot identify a microbe. All it does is replicate fragments of nucleic acids. That's all it does. That's a remarkable thing, but that's a far cry from being used properly used as a medical device. So there again, you get to crimes against humanity, that people are being led to believe, just like they were in AIDS, that if you get a positive test on this thing, that you have some deadly thing going on, and you better start taking your toxic medications, which in the case of AIDS, the second part of your question there, that was a self-fulfilling prophecy. Actually, with COVID, too, but it's a little bit different. We can look at that. In AIDS, you had people... AIDS is complicated to talk about because it depends on which set of years you're talking about. You know, from 1979 up through like 2015, every few years they were changing definitions and adding diseases and getting new medications. It's like it's so difficult to talk about in a coherent fashion. But in the very early days, all the people with what they called AIDS were actually sick. And, of course, the common denominator for the vast majority was some type of drug use, whether it was so-called recreational or pharmaceutical drugs generally. Just massive amounts in their bodies, and it was making them sick, as you would expect, knocking down their immune systems, their energy systems, so they couldn't stay healthy. All right, so now many of those people, of course, then were given these other toxic medications, and that sadly, disgustingly, finished them off. Well, once you have the discovery of the alleged HIV, okay, now, just like with COVID, you're getting people who are testing positive who have no symptoms. However, they believe, oh, my God, they're told, you have a deadly virus. You better get on these medications. They have toxic side effects, but it's okay because at least you're fighting the deadly HIV. So you, in essence, you have healthy people taking things like the AZT and DDI and DDC and whatever all the other packages were back then, of these nucleoside analogs that interrupt cell division, which guarantees that you're going to start wasting away. This happened with the protease inhibitors later too. You know, you're interfering with protein synthesis, and you're interrupting the process of dividing cells. That's a prescription for death. Your cells can't divide, and you can't synthesize proteins. I mean, there you have a wasting syndrome by prescription. Awful. So, and that's all based on the fear. This is crimes against humanity. These are sociopaths that we're working with because they don't care. And it's not even just about money. I mean, I would argue parenthetically, rather than get into this, there's a deeper sickness here, something that Wilhelm Reich called the emotional plague. People talk about money and power. Yeah, money and power are part of it, but there's a deeper sickness among these people like the Faucis and the Gates and the rest of them because they need to micromanage people's lives. They need to control people. They need to take their freedom away. You know, they're like a monster that feeds on freedom. You know, that's why noncompliance is like really the ultimate answer to this. But anyway, so these are sociopaths that go after freedom, and they don't care. They don't care that people are dying horrible deaths with these medications. In AIDS and now COVID, of course, the big thing was not even just the medications. It was the ventilators. That was the big scandal. Mostly elderly people, not just elderly, but many of them being put on ventilators. And I forgot the number. It was like 97, 98, or 99% of the people put on the ventilators die. I mean, why would you even risk that? I mean, that's, again, another crime against humanity. At best, just blind obedience. But for those who are dictating these protocols, this is crimes against humanity. So in COVID, with the medications, okay, here, what's a little bit different from AIDS is you have these classic medications, and you know, you and I are alternative health people. We wouldn't even think this way, but even you look at the things like the hydroxychloroquine and the ivermectin, okay, these really have genuine evidence that, I mean, they've been around forever. They're relatively non-toxic. They help people with basic cold and flu and respiratory-like symptoms. It's like, okay, so people who do conventional medicine, let them do that. Let them deal with their flus and colds and other respiratory problems. What happens is, because Anthony Fauci and the rest of them have a conflict of interest, right? They have some relationship to the patents on these new drugs and on these vaccines. Well, they have to come out and say, oh, hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, these are unproven medications, even though they've been around for decades. These are dangerous. Lying through their teeth. Crimes against humanity. Why? Because if there are workable and successful medications available, you can't get your emergency authorization use, which shoo-ins these the remdesivir, you know, these other antivirals, and the vaccines. You know, you can't do that unless you don't have any other viable medication. So they've come out and they have lied to the public. Straight face. I'm telling you, this is, I'm sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to use this word. These are sociopaths. There's no way you can speak with your own self-interest, knowing it's harming other people, and then even finding excuses why you have to take other people's freedom away to keep them under your thumb. This whole thing, as you can tell, this infuriates me and sickens me. This fires up what I call the freedom fire. Okay, this is what we need to ignite in people. That's what I hope your show is doing, is we're reaching people to reawaken them to the fact that, no, there isn't some deadly pandemic thing going around. This is a pandemic of ripping people's freedom out of their hands. And on some level, people know this. That's why they have this full range of emotions. Like at the beginning of COVID, I remember, you know, back in March and April of last year, people were feeling a little weird because they weren't allowed to work. That's a biological function. That's a part of health. It's like sex. It's your work function. It's part of your health. It's part of your identity. But this is being blocked. People aren't allowed to work. They're not allowed to socialize. This made people feel weird, depressed, upset, angry, confused. Well, that constellation of emotions is a freedom fire. On some level, they know their basic freedom to socialize, to love, to work is being blocked. There's a bunch of justifications and excuses that don't make sense, but people don't know how to navigate that. They don't understand that what they're feeling is the fact that somebody is coming after their freedom. You know, to me, that's underneath all of this. What this COVID and AIDS, all of this is about reclaiming our freedom. We have to recognize that we are free individuals, that we have a right to our freedom, and that if somebody comes to us and is trying to tell us that we have to get rid of the First Amendment, we have to get rid of free speech, if you're talking about vitamin C or ivermectin or whatever else, you know, if you can't talk about those things, then you know you are coming face to face with a fascist, with a tyrant who is out to eat up your freedom. And you have to respond to that. You have to push back on that. You have to reclaim that lost territory. And then, like they say in the Declaration of Independence, you know, bring in the guards for our future security. But people don't see this. Most people are too decent. They see the smiling scoundrel come up and say, oh, deadly disease going around. You must surrender your freedom to save
Tom,
your fellow man. And you got to go, no, there's something wrong.
Refocus for a moment, please. People know the emotional downdraft of being sucked into this vortex of compliance by fiat. They have no choice. If they don't comply, they will be fired, or they can't go back to college, or many different ways of hurting a person today with the cancel culture aligning itself with the administration. Let's go back to AIDS. Gallo created a test. Never discusses the fact that he makes money every time someone is given an HIV test. But go through what's wrong with the test, because this was the first big red flag that we are being lied to. We're being many people who do not have AIDS conditions and don't have HIV are being told after getting this test they do. In fact, the test was so inaccurate that if you were tested in one country and it tested you positive, you could go to another country, it would test you negative. And there was one journalist, Christine Johnson, who more than anyone else I knew just sat methodically as a science writer and went through the literature, because a test should have a gold standard of accuracy. That's meaning, right. If you're going to have this blood chemistry taken and you're testing it for HIV antibodies, then it can't test for anything else. Because what if you had hepatitis or malaria, or you were pregnant, or you had the flu vaccine? All of those would test you positive for HIV antibody test. Well, then the HIV antibody test is no longer a gold standard. And she began to keep adding and adding and adding more conditions that would test you positive even though you had no HIV. And that's what got my attention so much. So I flew out to California and filmed her for an afternoon because I wanted to get her into a documentary I was doing at the time. So take us through the fraud of the HIV antibody test that everybody had to get. And by the way, even I had to get it as a part of my corporate insurance. And I had to get it every year. And I would sign a statement stating that I'm doing this under duress, that this is not a scientific test. They didn't care. Of course, I was always negative. But I just wanted people to realize that for a lot of insurances, you couldn't keep your insurance if you didn't get this test. So everybody was told you're all equally vulnerable to being HIV infected. If you're a virgin living in Wyoming in a farm, if you're a nun in a convent upstate New York, everybody's got to get the test because you're all equally susceptible. That was the lie being told. Then you got the test to see if you were positive. And because of a lot of underlying health conditions, a lot of people who had no HIV in their body tested positive. Then they were told to go immediately onto the drugs. In fact, I was the only person opposing AZT at the New York University Medical School debate. There were four physicians, myself, most were either urologists or internal medicine or some other background. They supported AZT. And around the side of the walls of this lecture were guys holding posters saying, put time on your side, you know, take AZT. Right. And so the big push was, we've got to have a drug to treat this. And I'm saying, look at the evidence. This drug AZT was created by a scientist at the National Cancer Institute. He found it so toxic that he would not recommend it for terminally ill people as a drug of last resort. And it didn't matter what science I brought forward. Also, yes. I was talking about the people that I was working with at the Tri-State Healing Center that were getting well and who did have AIDS-defining conditions without any drugs. They didn't want to hear that either. So take us on that journey right now, please, Tom.
So with the test, okay, one of the ways that I was able to make sense of this for myself and to try to keep it accessible to people, because it's, you know, a lot of people freak out when they hear the word science. They think that automatically means it's over your head, and it's not. Always come back to physical reality. So you're raising the question of the gold standard, which really is the starting point on this HIV test, or even the corona, the COVID, the SARS test. So what are they physically dealing with? Okay, with the HIV test, they weren't actually dealing with a full viral entity, or, you know, what's called a genome, a whole integrated thing. What they're dealing with, like with the Western blot and the ELISA, are proteins. Okay, so there's certain proteins which are measured by a molecular weight. So that's part of the physical reality of what you're dealing with. You're not dealing with a virus, you're dealing with proteins. Now, the claim is, okay, and these are, like I said, they have molecular weights, like I've since forgotten the numbers, but there's like P21, P11, P34, or whatever. They're named by the molecular weight, okay? So the assumption, and this is where there's no science, the assumption is that these proteins are unique to the thing called HIV. That's why you need the gold standard. The gold standard is the actual physical entity. I mean, this is just common sense. I mean, we're missing so much common sense. All right, you have an entity. If it's supposed to be there, you should be able to find it in the blood, isolate it, take pictures of it, pick it apart, and find what is unique about it. And then, if you need to use a test that doesn't test for the whole thing, you could test for the parts and kind of put them together. But you need the original thing in the first place. Well, they never found an actual HIV. They just had proteins, and then they assumed, they claimed these proteins are unique to HIV. Okay, that's where Christine Johnson comes in with her listing of all these cross-reactions with these things, because these proteins are not unique to an HIV. In fact, what Eleni Papadopoulos showed with the Perth group, and that's the biggest paper for anybody who wants the science on this, go to Biotechnology magazine in 1993, is a Western blot proof of HIV infection. And in there, they parse out the four major critical problems with the test. And the biggest one is that there's no gold standard. So you have these proteins, and what they show is most, I'm forgetting if it's most or all of these proteins, are also identical to endogenous proteins that just from cellular debris, when cells die and reproduce in your system, they break down into these nucleic acids and various proteins. And if you find those proteins, some of them are identical to the P11, the P21, the P34. So in many cases, you're just finding natural proteins from natural metabolism. And then you're telling somebody they have a deadly disease because all they're doing is being alive. I mean, another crime against humanity. So you were also invoking the referring to testing positive in one country and negative in another country. This gets to the questions of specificity, and now I'm going blank on the other word, which you probably know, of when you have to be able to identify certain specific characters of these proteins, and also combinations of them. So, for example, in Australia, they'll say if you have P31 and P12, but in America, if you have P31 and P34 and P11, okay, depending on which country, how they define a positive result, that's how it is. You can get a positive result in one country, move to the other country, and then you get a negative result with the same blood sample. Okay, again, this is so ridiculous. I mean, this means there is no science here. And all these things are detailed much better than I could in that original paper. And then Christine Johnson also did a popular version of that. I'm forgetting what that excellent article was called. I think it was called Whose Antibodies Are They Anyway, I think. So you're talking, the physical reality is you're dealing with proteins and enzymes, okay, the reverse transcriptase enzyme. When they see these in a blood sample, they say, oh, therefore HIV is there. But without that gold standard, you don't know that. All you know is that you have cellular metabolism going on. So this raises an interesting point, and this is something that Dr. Stefan Lanka used to point out, as did Dr. Roberto Hurado. Okay, so what value is the HIV test, if anything, is particularly the Western blot? What is it? Can you save it in any way? Okay, well, we know there's not an HIV. We know there's these random proteins. However, these proteins do seem to be associated with, you know, normal breakdown metabolism and also stress proteins. So what that would mean at best, okay, I'm stretching here, but at best would mean if you test positive on an HIV test, all that means is you may have a higher concentration of stress proteins in your system. Okay, it doesn't mean you have a deadly virus. It means you have a higher concentration of stress proteins, and that's worth looking at. What are my health risks in life? Am I eating too crappy? Am I living too much stress? Am I not getting enough sleep? Am I taking too many drugs? You know, what are my genuine health risks? And take that seriously. So you wouldn't see an HIV positive test as a deadly death sentence or that you have a deadly virus. You would simply see it as maybe I need to clean up my life. And maybe, and again, I'm stretching, that's at best. Now it's more complicated, just to interject you, with the COVID, because they're mostly using the PCR with these cycle thresholds. Well, all that should be thrown out. I mean, Dr. David Raznik, who I think you might be interviewing, he points out the PCR as a medical test should be banned. It should be banned. Okay, this is crime against humanity territory again. I also just recently found out modern medicine is doing a lot of PCR tests for many microbes. It's all bullcrap. You can't do it. And yet it's becoming the standard method of testing and diagnosing people and then treating them based on something that is a complete fantasy. This is terrible. Anyway, but back to the test. And then one other thing, Dr. Roberto Hurado wrote a very interesting paper on whether or not, you know, again, who is, I'm forgetting the name of the article, I'm sorry, I think it was who's positive anyway. And what he did was he took the blood from 20 people, not a big sample, but this is a start, kind of a quick and dirty test. He took a sample of blood from 20 people who, by the conventional way of doing the test, all tested negative. Okay, one of the weird things that Roberto saw about this test is they use these high dilutions. Now, they've since, over the decades, they're using lower numbers, but still, the point is relevant. Had this extremely high dilution of, like, for example, in the ELISA test, of 400 to 1, okay, 400, you know, to one molecule of serum, 400 molecules of dilutant, okay, that's outlandish. Normally, you might do 5 to 1, 10 to 1, you know, because you have to dilute the serum to do the actual experiment or the test you're doing. This was 400 to 1. So Roberto said, that's odd. Why are you doing 400 to 1 dilution? So what he did was he took the blood of all these negative people at the 400 dilution, and he ran their blood through the test without diluting it. And you know what he found out? Everybody's positive. Everybody tests positive for HIV if you don't dilute the blood. So what does that mean? Well, that's where you have to understand the proteins. Because, again, it means if there is any value to this test, and again, I can't help but say it, but I'm stretching here. If there's any value to the test, it is sensitive to concentrations of breakdown products in your body. So the more you dilute the blood, if you are still testing positive, that means you have a higher concentration of these nucleic acids or breakdown products. And thus, you may have a stress situation or something to consider a health risk. Now, this is the same with the COVID, too. If you are getting things produced at a lower cycle threshold, then that means you have a higher concentration. This is what you were alluding to. You know, if you're doing a real low cycle threshold and you're testing positive, again, doesn't mean you have any deadly virus, but it means that these metabolic proteins of just normal metabolism or cellular death, that you have more than most people, and maybe you should, again, if you wanted to salvage this test, it would just be a question of concentration of breakdown products in the organism. That's and nothing more. That's the best you can get for it. Anyway, any other angles on that you want
to? No, let me go a little further on that. Thank you for that explanation, Tom. What I found was, and this, again, this is not theoretical. This is me counseling about 2,000 individuals over a period of 1974 to about 2010. And I worked with all those people, 1,200 of them was in one protocol at the Tri-State Healing Center. Not one of them died. All of them were HIV positive with multiple illnesses. None were healthy. None were asymptomatic. Everyone reversed their disease state. And we saw it over a period of time. It wasn't overnight. Generally, it took 16 months. But the people that were volunteered to be on an accelerated protocol, 200,000 milligrams of intravenous vitamin C, glutathione, all forms of other therapeutic models, ozone, intravenous, autohemotherapy, they're the ones who not only seroconverted from HIV positive to negative, but all symptoms gone. And then in came the journalist and to see whether or not this was real. Tony Brown, Bill McCreary, the multi-Emmy award-winning journalist from Channel 5. Tony Brown had the most popular program on PBS stations around the country. Doug Henderson, yeah, a lawyer and journalist, African-American. Bill Tatum, publisher of the Amsterdam News, the largest African-American newspaper in the United States. And others, they spent a lot of time, we're talking about months, with the permission of the patients. They interviewed the patients, they reviewed the patients' medical records, they interviewed the physicians, they went over reams of biochemistry, because we were having Roche Labs, a division of Hoffman Roche, that was doing the blood workups. So we had absolute proof of every step of this. So nobody could say, well, how do you know if they actually had AIDS? And, well, here's all their blood workup, here's all their tests, and here's how the viral load decreased and they got well. And I was curious, why isn't anyone interested in this? And it was because the manufacturers of these antiretrovirals were giving huge amounts of money. to select individuals and groups to promote their drug, and only a drug approach. And there was a hostility. The hostility came when people were called AIDS deniers because they needed some way to shut them up, to keep them out of the argument and debates, because every debate we would win because we had the truth on our side. They didn't.
Right.
But one of the most revealing parts of this was in Africa. And several of the scientists and physicians working in Africa, including health ministers in Africa of several countries, I interviewed personally. In fact, I gave them protocols. And this is what one of the physicians in Africa at an AIDS orphanage, meaning only children who were HIV positive could get into that orphanage. And it was packed. He had hundreds in there. And over a period of time, thousands. And he said to me, he said, all these kids come in here. They're all malnourished. They have multiple parasitic infections, schistosomiasis. And I treat them for the diseases that they have. Malnutrition, we make sure they get a good diet and vitamin supplementation, especially vitamin A, D, C. If they have parasitic infections, we treat them with antiparasitical drugs, including ivermectin, for example.
Yeah.
And hydroxychloroquine has also been used the same. We give them healthy, clean water that their village may not have had. There's good sanitation. And guess what? Not a single one dies, and they all return to total health, and they're all HIV negative. So he said, but nobody wants to hear this. Why? He said, because the local AIDS people come around in these $80,000 RV from the NGOs and give you condoms and posters. And that's it. He said, how do you get diagnosed? These were just poor families whose children were dying, and they brought them here. Now, how do they test for HIV in Africa? Well, do you have a non-productive dry cough? Have you lost weight? Do you have a fever? If you have those, immediately they say you have AIDS. Now, those are also the same conditions from tuberculosis, malaria, and a myriad of these other diseases which are common. So I ask a basic question. In fact, this question was asked of the president of South Africa, Mbeki, at the time. If you go down to Cape Town, you'll see that the city is structured in a hierarchical order where the wealthiest magnates, the industrialists, they had the big mansions high up in the hills. Then your mercantile class, your business class, they are the next level. Then you have your government employees, the firefighters, police officers, school teachers, scientists, etc. They're the next level. Then you have your independent laborers. They're the next. And then you have a big field, a trailings field from mining. And then you have the ghettos where people don't have running water. They don't have sewage. They have open latrines. They have open windows where mosquitoes come in. Now, here's I said, is it possible that a virus is so smart that will not infect you if you're any one of the five classes that have clean water, lots of food, healthy environment, and have protection from malaria, from mosquitoes? It only knows to infect the poorest, those who are already immune compromised. That's a really unique virus that will fly over hundreds of thousands of people to infect those who are poor. So it's a class virus, right?
Yeah.
Well, that was the word that I put out.
Everybody knows
the people who were meeting with Mbeki and also the health ministers. And everyone understood that that just was common sense. That was all over Africa. So when you start looking at who is being infected, intravenous drug users, fast track, either heterosexual or homosexuals, lifestyles, those using amyl nitrate or poppers, those parting a lot, those who had repeated sexually transmitted diseases, those were the ones, the hemophiliacs. And then I ask, well, okay, if this is sexually transmitted, surely then all the partners would also be infected. And when I raised that question, we began to then look at all the people who were, that we knew of, who were infected. Is your partner, where you've had unprotected sex repeatedly, thousands of times, are they infected? And the answer was no. So then that raised a whole new issue. We've been told this is sexually transmitted. Is it? And they couldn't answer that. And then the direction changed, and they started saying this was a African-American disease. There was even such draconian ideas as they would be quarantined until they were tested, and otherwise they would stay away from the rest of society. And I wanted to track down this absolutely insane notion, and it came from someone who had done a test at Hall Hospital in Brooklyn. So I went over to Hall Hospital, and I interviewed all the people there, and I found out that that was an indigenous hospital. It's where the poorest of the poor, lots of drug addicts, and the people who were tested were HIV-positive drug addicts who were pregnant. And so I said, okay, we know that drug addicts, forget the clean needles, they're infected with multiple diseases, hepatitis, rampant. So then I said, let's go to an area where you have educated, wealthy African-Americans who are pregnant, test their blood. Ah, suddenly no HIV. So once again, an HIV virus is so smart that it will not infect you if you have these conditions, but if you're druggy, yes, you can get infected.
That's right.
And so I did some articles on all these, and I took on the whole AIDS establishment because I had a person who was my support team, a publisher of a major magazine, read by millions of people every month, and I did 58 cover story articles on this, plus documentaries, and I was debating this issue. And everything that I saw that was being told to us was certainly by Anthony Fauci and Robert Gallo. You could drive a truck through it. And that's when I heard about some of the dissidents and then your group. And when I began to look at the credentials of the scientists, including multiple Nobel Prize winners and multiple professors emeritus and virologists like Stefan Lankia, top people in their field, no controversy in their field, and they're also saying there are just too many discrepancies between the real science and the corporate science and the real way of healing versus the drug, a multiple drug approach. Your thoughts on these issues, please.
Yeah, a number of things. I went over to Africa twice in the early, I think in 2000 and 2001. And one of the things that we noted, I thought one of the best summaries of what you were seeing there was if you use the term HIV and substitute it with the word poverty, and then take the word AIDS and substitute it with the diseases of poverty, you would instantly understand what you were dealing with. I remember being taken on a little bit of a tour in South Africa. We were in a small group, and it was Dr. Sam Mlongo, who was President Mbeki's personal physician. And he was taking us around and showing us some things. And I remember when we were up on this elevated area and looking down on this enormous area of shanty towns and just stand, I'd never seen poverty like that in my life, certainly, because, I hadn't been to those types of areas before, some of those like in South America or Africa or other places. And just looking at these thousands and thousands and thousands of shanty towns right next to each other, all made of just metal shacks where you don't have any running water and you have to walk miles to kind of like bring some food back. You see people walking on the street for miles. You're carrying a few vegetables or whatever. And you look at that, and this is where the common sense comes in. You go, okay, why are these people not healthy? Why are they getting sick? Is it because they're having unprotected sex? Or is it simply because they don't have any food and water and they're living under incredibly stressful conditions? I mean, the answer was obvious. And it's unmistakable if you stand there and look at that. And if you stand there and look at that and you think, oh, this is all about condoms, you're crazy. I can see if you're living in an office somewhere or in an upscale building and you never see things like a shanty town, how it, you can convince yourself that it's a sexually transmitted disease, and you can come out and be a big proponent of condoms and all, and then get your nice big checks from SmithKline and whatever else. But if you actually stand there and look at reality, you see, no, that's not the case at all. I think you were talking about one of the researchers you may have interviewed. I think you were talking about Philippe Crenon, and his story.
Yes.
His story totally fascinated me, too. Neville Hodgkinson did a story on him in the Sunday Times of London back in the early 90s. And here was a guy, I think he and his wife, I forgot her name, and they, just kind of like, good-hearted people. They said, oh, my God, like so many people did. They said, let's go to Africa and help people with AIDS. We must be able to do something. So he goes there, and he goes there believing in the virus and all this, and his firsthand experience, this was like us at Heal. We weren't ideologues. We weren't coming up with philosophies and things. We just looked at what was right in front of our face and described it accurately, in a way that we could apply ourselves and get actually real results. That's what Crenon did. He went out there. He saw what I saw. He said, well, first of all, how about we just get these people some food? Let's get some food and some clean water, maybe some clothes, and give you a little bit of privacy, a tiny little space here, where you can take care of yourself. And that alone, you see people recover their health. No surprise. Completely nonsensical.
Tom, so, unfortunately, we are out of time. I'm looking at the clock now. I want to thank you very much for all of your decades of work helping people understand how to survive AIDS and the group. So I'm going to give them your website so they can go for more information, rethinkingaids.com, rethinkingaids.com. Thank you very much for being with us today, Tom.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall. My guest, Tom, and I'll let me spell his name, D-I-F-E-R-D-I-N-A-N-D-O. Have a nice day, everyone.